Passion for God and compassion for our neighbor. Reaching our region and beyond with the life-changing message of Jesus Christ. This is Faith Church. And now, Pastor Kurt Truxas.
Have you ever just really felt alone? You know, it's the middle of the night and you wake up and you wonder, where am I going? What's life all about? I mean, I'm born, I live, and I die. Like, what's my purpose? Have you ever felt that way? Maybe for you, it's not that you feel alone, but you feel not purposeless, but you feel powerless. You ever had an issue of sin in your life where you have just, you've promised yourself you won't do it again? Maybe it's an issue of anger. You find yourself being giving into it again and again, and it's how your tongue is used. Maybe it's an issue of lust. You've sworn off of it, but then you go right back to it again. It's like you're a slave to your own sinful desires and you're powerless to overcome it. Have you ever felt that way? Well, if you've ever felt purposeless in this world or powerless over your sin, you've come to the right place, because we're going to talk about that this morning. Now, if you're new, I'd like to welcome you. My name is Kurt. I'm one of the pastors here at Faith Church. And as a church, we're working our way through the Gospel of John. And this morning we come to John chapter 8, verse 12. So I'd like to ask everybody to open their Bibles, turn to John chapter 8, verse 12. If you do not have a Bible, please take out one of the pew Bibles in front of you. It's found on page 894. I'd like to also ask you to take out a copy of the notes. It's in your bulletin there, so you can follow along with what we're going to do this morning. I'm actually going to read John chapter 8, verses 12 through 20 this morning. Though in actuality, the text we are going to seek to cover is actually through verse 30. But we're just going to focus on the earlier section. So I'd like to ask you to stand out of reverence for God's word as we read John chapter 8, 12 through 20. Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. So the Pharisees said to him, you are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. And Jesus answered, well, even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I am going. But you do not know where I come from or where I am going. You judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. Yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true. For it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. In your law it is written that the testimony of two men is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me. They said to him, therefore, well, where is your Father? And Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple. But no one arrested him, because his hour had not yet come. That ends the reading of God's word. You may be seated. Now, I just want to be real straight with you. You can be honest with me. As I read that, did that sound confusing? Clear as mud, right? Yeah, it sort of sounds confusing. You don't need to be ashamed of it, because that it is confusing. It is tough stuff, because there's so many little metaphors and innuendos that are all packed in that little bit of text there. In fact, I just want you to know that not many pastors preach on the eighth chapter of John. As I did my research, for some reason, a lot of guys like to skip it because they say it is too confusing to preach and to teach. Well, like Star Trek fans, we are going to boldly go where no man has gone before. We're going to teach John chapter 8, verse 12. And I want you to know that while a lot of people avoid this text, it actually has some very rich and very powerful things in it about Jesus Christ. So I want to prepare you this morning. What you are going to learn, for some of you, it'll completely reshape your understanding of the Old Testament. For others of you, what you're about ready to learn will completely reshape your understanding of the entire Bible. There is big stuff in this tough text that we're about ready to learn this morning. So, let's go ahead and get ready to dive right into this thing. Now, as we look to handle this, I want to just give you a framework to understand what's going on here in verse 12 down to verse 30. How many of you have watched the presidential debates? Good. A number of you have watched those. And you know a debate is sort of it's not really well structured, is it? They try to structure it, and they give time limits, and no, you can't talk anymore, and this is the new topic, but it's all over the place. One person says something, somebody responds. It's pretty random, and it's a back-and-forth kind of a deal. Now, if you look at your copy of the Word, you'll learn in here, what's going on is actually a debate. Jesus makes a claim in verse 12, and what happens is there's a back-and-forth debate exchange between him and the religious leaders. It goes rather quickly. In fact, you can see that if you have the words of Christ in red, in your text, you'll see red, black, red, black, red, black, back and forth debate kind of structure. Now, I'm going to spare you the pain of getting into the details of the debate, which I would love to do it, trust me, but you may not love if I do it. So I'm going to not do that. What we're going to do is we're going to look just at verse 12. Because what happens is Jesus makes a claim in verse 12, and it's because he makes this claim that this debate is sparked off. So if you want to get at what the real crux of this passage is about, it's really the claim that Jesus makes in verse 12. And that's all we're going to focus on this morning. So let's look at this claim. Jesus' claim, here it is: I am the light of the world. And here it is. Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Who has ever heard that verse before? You all went to Sunday school. Okay, well, I've heard this since I was a kid. You've heard this. I mean, it doesn't sound that revolutionary. I am the light of the world. It sounds sort of innocuous, almost hard to understand. But yet I want you to realize those words were enough to set people's hair on fire in the first century. I mean, they were. In case you doubt that, remember what we read in verse 20, which is why I read all the way down to verse 20. Look what it says here. It says, these words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple. But no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. In other words, John is very surprised that Jesus was not arrested for saying these words. He's surprised he didn't throw him in jail. In fact, he says the only reason that Jesus was not arrested is because of God's supernatural protection of him at this time. So apparently to say, I am the light of the world, really can get people upset. We don't connect with it because we're not Jewish. We don't come from that culture. But it's really a big claim. So what I think we need to do is we need to get in contact with the Jewish culture and the Jewish background and understand why saying I am the light of the world is such a big thing. Now, in the interest of time, I decided last night I'm not going to do these next two sections of my outlines. I wanted to make sure we got you out of here to Faith University on time. So, just so you know, I stripped that section out and I put in the small group worksheet online last night a digging deeper section. It's not the one that's out in the foyer, but if you want to know the section here where it says the Bible uses light and darkness as a metaphor to describe the world, if you want that, go ahead and pull the small group worksheet from the online version. So let's go ahead and turn all the way to page 2. Let's go to light and darkness. It's the background of John chapter 8. Light and darkness is the background of John chapter 8. So here you go. Remember back 3 weeks ago when we were last in this text, Jesus was at the Feast of Booths. It's 6 months prior to his crucifixion. We learned about the Feast of Booths. This was a feast that they celebrated at the end of harvest season. It was a feast that brought them back to the time when they didn't have a harvest, when they wandered for 40 years in the wilderness, and God took care of them during that time. And they celebrated it. One way was by living in these little pup tents. And these pup tents were just willow and palm branches and a few other branches, it says in Nehemiah, actually woven together into these flimsy structures. So it looked like everybody was at a KOA camping convention in Jerusalem. That's what it was like. That's how they remember that they used to not have a home to live in and not have a land to call their own, not have a harvest. And 3 weeks ago when we looked at this text, we looked at the water pouring ceremony. Because another way that they remembered this is every morning the priest, he would go down to the pool of Siloam and he would take a pitcher or sort of a bowl and he would scoop some water from the pool and he would walk back to the altar and he'd hold it high in the air and slowly he'd pour it onto the altar. And in the morning the crowds gathered round and they cheered with excitement as he did that. Now, why did they do that? It was a way they remembered how God had provided for them water from the rock in the desert when they were dying of thirst. And we looked at this 3 weeks ago, that actually Paul says that rock was Christ. That Christ had provided for them the water in the desert. It's in the Corinthian letters when we looked at it back then. Now, what happens here? Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Remember down in verse 20, he said this in a place called the treasury. Let me explain to you where that is. In the temple, I didn't have a picture for you, but in the temple, there's what's called the court of the women. That's sort of the outer layer of the temple proper. There's no roof above it, just walls. And what happens is, this is as far as the women were allowed to go. After that, it was just men and eventually priests, and you have the Holy of Holies in the center. So in this open area without a roof, in the court of the women, which is also the place of the treasury where everybody put their offering, there were 13 funnels in the wall that they could put their money in. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Still doesn't connect. Doesn't sound that impressive until you look at the Jewish background. You see, during the Feast of Booths, in the treasury right there, they had an enormous candelabra. And what happened was the young priests would take barrels of water, of oil rather, and they put a ladder onto the candelabra and they'd go to the top and they'd fill this candelabra with oil. And then at night, when the sun went down, they would light this candelabra and the flames would go up into the top of the sky and lick the darkness. And the Mishnah, which is sort of the Jewish writings of the day by rabbis, it says that these flames were so bright and so high that there was not a courtyard in all of Israel that was not illuminated, at least in some way, by the brightness of these flames. Now, think with me on this. If they did the water pouring ceremony to remember the time when God provided water out of the rock during their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, what would a tall flame that lit the night be helping them remember? What was that? The pillar of fire. The pillar of fire that led them by night throughout the wilderness. And it was a cloud by day. And this is what's going on. They're trying to remember that. And underneath this, these candelabra, the priests would gather. They would dance during the night. The temple orchestra would strike up a tune. And people would gather and they'd celebrate. Now, I'm going to spare you the details of this, but we know from chapter 7 that the water pouring ceremony, that when he spoke about this, it was on the seventh day. Right now, when Jesus steps in front of the candelabra and says, I am the light of the world, it is the eighth day. In other words, it's the last morning of the ceremony. It's sort of like a New Year's Eve day when you guys take down the Christmas tree. You know how you do that? And everyone's a little, okay, well, festivities are over. We're a little depressed about that. That's the general feeling that everybody has. Festivities are over. Oh, well, no more partying till next year. And here's what's been going on. That large flame, it represented to them the time when God's presence and God's glory dwelled among them in the wilderness. And that glory has been gone for hundreds of years. So they've represented it with this candelabra and the flames off of it. But now that is over with and it's gone. And everyone's sort of depressed. Jesus steps in front and says, I am the light of the world. What is Jesus claiming? He just claimed to be God's glory and presence that is now back among them. Except this time, it's not in a pillar of flame, but it's in the flesh. I'm back. That's what he said. And not only that, but I want you to notice this. This may not be apparent to you, but Jesus is claiming to be, you know, so to speak, the one who brought their ancestors out of slavery and bondage in Egypt. He is the one who freed them in the Old Testament. And now he's back in the New Testament. He's equating himself with the Shekinah glory. Now, I want you to think about this, because this is going to open up things in a whole new perspective for you this morning. What he is saying is that in the Old Testament, God's people were in slavery, and they were condemned to death in Egypt. And what happened is Jesus brought them out of slavery and death in Egypt, and he led them through the wilderness, and he brought them to the promised land. Now, Jesus is back, except this time, and we're playing the Exodus tape all over again, except this time it's not playing softly. This time the volume is cranked all the way to the max. The slavery that he's freeing people from is slavery to sin, something that we all struggle with. The death that he frees people from is eternal condemnation. And then he's not just freeing ancient Israel, he's freeing God's people throughout the world. And the promised land that he's bringing them to is not just over a spot over here in ancient Israel, but it's the new heavens and the new earth all over again. And he is going to be leading them all the way there. This is huge. Now, I know a number of you are saying, well, really? You're trying to tell me that Jesus was the one who freed God's people out of slavery in the land of Egypt? Let's put our finger back in the text. That's my little motto, isn't it? What do we find here? I did some research. It says, then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. The pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud in the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. This is Exodus 14. Now, how many of you have been here in at least 4 years? A couple of you. Remember, if you go back 4 years, we did a Christmas series called On Angels. Remember that? There was a message in that series where we looked at something called the angel of the Lord or the angel of God. And what we learned is when you find it says in the Old Testament text, the angel of the Lord, that seems to be a pre-incarnate manifestation of Jesus Christ. Not an angel of the Lord, that's like Mr. Generic Angel, but the angel of the Lord is given all throughout the Old Testament. It's given all the qualities of divinity. So apparently, and it's usually Christ is what the scholars think. So apparently we have Christ here and the cloud somehow going together, protecting ancient Israel as they came out of Egypt. Now, start to think about this. He's the water, Paul says, that provided the rock that provided the water for ancient Israel. And he was the lamb that was slain. Remember this from Hebrews? So the angel of death would pass over them. Now, we learned this back, I think it was John chapter 5, when Jesus fed the 5,000. Where did they instantly go and think? The people thought of Moses and the manna. And he said it wasn't Moses who provided the manna. Who provided the manna? Jesus. Jesus in the Old Testament all over again. Now, I started doing some more research on this and thinking about this. And I found this really interesting little passage here in Luke. It says, As he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered, and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now, it says departure in the English, but if you read it in the Greek, the word departure is exodus. In other words, Moses is talking with him about the exodus that he's about to accomplish in Jerusalem. That when he dies on the cross, the exodus motif is going to take place all over again. Remember, but this time it's on full power. Not slavery from physical slavery and slavery from death in Egypt, but now we're talking about slavery to sin and eternal condemnation that he is freeing people from. Now, I want this to just change the way you look at the scriptures. The Bible is not two books, an Old Testament and a New Testament, where all of a sudden Jesus was on vacation in the Old Testament, and then he shows up after being in Barbados in the New Testament, and it starts there. It's one book. Jesus saved his people in the Old Testament, and then God cranks the power up to max, and he saves his people in the New Testament. Exodus motif all over again. Now, I know this is going to be revolutionary for a number of you as you think about the scriptures and where Jesus Christ is in all of the scriptures. And as I spent a lot of time wrestling with this, because I thought, this is going to really knock your socks off as I'm telling you this, because you're going to say, I've never thought about the Old Testament with Jesus this way. And I said, well, should I do this? Because not a lot of guys preach about this. And in fact, it's not in a lot of the scholarly works. And I don't like when I'm out there by myself, because that generally means I'm wrong. And as I was praying about this, God brought a verse to mind, which sort of made the decision that we would teach this way. And it's Jude chapter 5. And to me, this just says it so clearly. And now I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved a people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. It was Jesus in the Old Testament. Now, another verse that is really helpful here comes out of Isaiah. This passage in Isaiah, by the way, it's a prophecy. It's talking about God's suffering servant. It's prophecy very specifically about Jesus. Just read the context. What does it say? It says, he says, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. In other words, it would be too small of a thing for you to just focus on ancient Israel. I will make you as a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. That's specifically the prophecy that Jesus is fulfilling when he says, I am the light of the world. Okay. Jesus is there to save the nations. Now, that's the claim that Jesus makes. I'm what you're remembering in the Old Testament. Guess what? It was me. I'm back, and now I'm saving I'm saving the nations. Now, let's look at the command on page 3 here. His command is, follow me. And Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness. What you need to understand here is you need to pick up this whole Old Testament Exodus motif as your interpretational cue as you read this. And here's where I think we go wrong. Many times we often look at salvation as a one-time point of decision. See, I have it in my Bible when I came forward at a Billy Graham crusade in 1973, and that's when I became a Christian. John will say that's nice, but that's not the way that he looks at it. He looks at it as follow me. In other words, just as ancient Israel had to follow the pillar of fire on a daily basis, so we have to follow Jesus on a daily basis. The Old Testament Israel is not just called to believe that the pillar of fire existed. They were called to follow the pillar of fire because the pillar of fire was moving. In fact, they also had to make a decision each day. Would they walk away from the pillar of fire and into darkness? You know, I think it looks nice over there. Let's go over there. Or would they follow the pillar of fire into the light? And what John is saying is we have a decision each and every day. Will we follow Jesus as we are doing our wilderness wandering time? Or will we follow our own designs and decisions and go off into the darkness? And here's the deal. The more we walk into the darkness, the farther away we walk from Jesus. So we have to daily choose to follow Christ. I put this down here. Jesus Christ, or following Jesus, is not a once-in-a-lifetime decision. It is a daily decision. And when we follow him, here's the promise he gives us. Jesus' promise. Number one, you will not walk in darkness. Remember I said earlier, have you ever felt purposelessness? That sense of what am I here for? Where am I going? I'm groping around in the darkness of life. You feel that way either because you don't know Jesus in the light of Jesus, or you're a Christian who has chosen to walk away from following the light. You're walking in your own designs and directions, not God's designs and directions in your life. And you feel purposeless. You feel random. Like, what is life about? Where am I going? Because you have walked away from the light. He promises when you follow him, you won't feel that way. The other thing I talked about at the very beginning was struggling with sin. I've talked to many Christians who struggle with besetting sin. And oftentimes they say to me, if I could just figure out how to get a handle on this sin, maybe it's their language, maybe it's their lust. And they think the issue is the sin. The issue is not the sin. The issue is a closer walk with Jesus. The issue is I need to follow the light, not just believe in the light. And when I follow the light and when I take joy in learning more about Jesus, praying to Jesus, enjoying Jesus, what happens is darkness loses its grip on me. Just like being under a light, darkness is scattered away. That's the metaphor that he's giving us here. Now, how does this whole idea of following Christ, freeing us from the grip of sin, work? Well, number one, that was the section I left out earlier. And number two, it's something we're also going to cover next week. So I'll just leave it at that. So, first promise, he says, when you follow him, you won't walk in darkness. The second promise is this: you will have the light of life. What does that mean? The word have here is interesting. It actually means possess something. And it's pulling again from another Old Testament Exodus motif. Who remembers what happened when Moses went up Mount Sinai? The guy turned into a human flashlight. Remember that? He spent time with God, and he sort of began to glow. And they came down, everybody turned the lights off, and let Moses power the room. Because he glowed, he radiated, he had the light. Now, what this is saying here is when we spend time with Jesus, when we follow him, what happens is our very countenance begins to change. We begin to radiate God's light. Not physically like a flashbulb, but you know how you're around people and they're just different? You're like, you know, you're different. Like, you spent time with Jesus. Jesus has changed you. And this is very apparent with somebody who becomes a Christian later in life when they've walked in a direction that is filled with darkness, and all of a sudden they've come to Christ and Christ's light has gone on in their life. And people around them, they look, you are so different. You're so changed. Well, it's because I have the light of life inside of me that now radiates out from me. This is a promise that God says when you spend time with me will happen. So the first promise he gives us when we follow him, which is a daily decision, by the way, we won't have darkness. Second promise is we will radiate light. Now, let me just wrap this up here. Number one, Jesus saved God's people from slavery and death in the land of Egypt. It's the Exodus motif. He was the one who did it. And on the cross, he saved us from slavery to sin and eternal death in the lake of fire. One book, one story, two exoduses. Except the second exodus that we're living under is much better. Number two, the only way to experience the freedom of Jesus that Jesus secured is by following him to the promised land. That's key. We follow Jesus on a daily basis. It's not just a once-in-a-lifetime choice. That's the only way to experience this light. Third, following Jesus is not a one-time decision. It's a daily decision. The light is moving. Fourth, the closer we walk to the light, the greater our freedom from sin, and the brighter we shine to the world. Now, for some of you that are here, you're Christians, and you say, oh, I can sort of understand this. That as I drift from Jesus, my life becomes more pervaded by darkness and less by light. As I follow Jesus, I become more like light. Others of you are not Christians. In fact, you're brand new. But you're saying, I want that. I struggle with sin, and I'm a slave to it. You know, I struggle with that sense of no purpose, and I need help. How do I begin? I've got a real simple piece of instruction here for you. This is how you begin. Just look. Just look to Jesus. It all begins when you say, I can't beat my sin. I don't know what my purpose is. I can't do anything. I throw my hands up, Jesus, and I'm turning to you. I'm just going to look to you. Because you know, it's when you look to the light, that's when you can begin to what? Follow the light. Let's pray. Dear Jesus, I thank you for this word this morning. I thank you for the hidden gem in here of your identity in the Old Testament. When you say that you are the light of the world, you are claiming to be the very Shekinah glory. And you're claiming to be the one who freed your people in the past, and you will free your people from slavery, of sin and death on the cross. Thank you for that. Not two books, but one book, one story. I ask that as we look at how we live our Christian lives, that we would understand very clearly that it is not a one-time decision, but it's a daily decision to follow you, to look to you, and to be led by you. So I ask that you would correct that in our hearts, that idea that we don't have to follow you daily. And I pray especially for those who are here this morning who have never chosen to follow you. I ask that this morning you would quicken their heart and they would just look. We ask this in Christ's precious name. Amen.
This has been a presentation of Faith Church. More of Pastor Kurt's sermons can be found online at christtoourculture.com. Thanks for being with us, and may God continue to enrich your life.